We come in our study of the Word of God to the 12th chapter of the book of Hebrews. And in our last study, we were talking about Hebrews 11, sometimes called the faith chapter, the chapter that tells us over and again that God's people worshiped, lived, did their work, followed God's leading, obeyed God, and things like that by faith. They walked by faith. And then we talked last time about how there were those who were persecuted and by faith endured mockings and scourgings and things like that. Now, chapter 12 goes on from that and says, "Wherefore, seeing we also encompassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses." The illustration in the background is what we call a stadium, where the crowd is gathered to watch the contest. They didn't have football, but that kind of thing. And we are compassed with so great a cloud of witnesses. And for that reason, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. Some things are not necessarily wrong, and yet they are weights. I think the illustration following that of the audience in the grandstand is of the athlete who back yonder used to put weights on his feet and run with the weights to build up his muscles. Now, so far as I know, there's no rule in the rule book that says you couldn't keep them on in a 2-mile run. I've done some running as a member of the track team many years ago, and the problem never came up. We got rid of all of the extra weight when we ran a mile or 2 miles. And this says there are some things that Christians ought to lay aside. They're not necessarily wrong, but they just weight. And then we are definitely, along with that, to set aside sin. And that can so easily beset us. And then we're to run with patience the race that is set before us. Running a race requires endurance and willpower. The willpower to keep on running when you're tired and thirsty and want to sit down for a while. Or lie down for a while. And this says Christian life is like a race, and we're to run with patience. Now, why do we run with patience? And how can we do it? Well, the next verse, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. We do, I think, almost everything we do. Some things are automatic, but most things we do because we have some motives, some reason for doing it, and sometimes the motivation is something in the future. And this says we're to look to Jesus. He is going to be the motivation for our running. He's the author and finisher of our faith. And Jesus ran this kind of race. He was the Son of God, of course. But for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. He said, in effect, it doesn't matter. And he was willing to bear, to endure, because of the joy of fulfilling the Father's will, the joys of the future, the joys of having the church, and things like this. And because of the joy set before him, he endured the cross. Because of the joy that's been promised to us as Christians, we are to press on day by day and run the race. And it says Jesus despised the shame and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. He's become victorious and finished his work. Now, verse 3 is just some more of the same. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. They crucified him, they mocked him. And consider Christ, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. If we don't look to Christ and see how he endured, we may become discouraged. We may get tired. And this says, faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood. This particular group hadn't met the violent persecution in your striving against sin. And he says to them, you've forgotten the exhortation, the encouragement, which speaks to you as children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. Now, I think this is a passage that we need to be mindful of. Whom the Lord loveth, he disciplines. As I mentioned once before, the word spanking doesn't quite do it. Discipline is more the idea of training, though the spanking may be included. But whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. The temptations and trials that come to a Christian are very often, commonly, after spiritual blessings and advances. Jesus was tempted after his baptism. Abel was killed after his sacrifice by faith. Noah, of all people, got drunk after the flood and after the ark had landed safely. Ms. Moses gave her husband a hard time after God called him to lead Israel. Amalek fights against Israel after they're delivered from Egypt. Elijah got discouraged and just took off completely out of the country after his wonderful victory at Mount Carmel. Stephen resisted and was stoned after he began to preach. Paul was converted, and then he had to flee like a criminal very often. The church of Jerusalem began to grow, and then bitter persecutions began. John Mark had problems on the first missionary journey and quit. A young missionary, we'd call him. Augustine got sick after his conversion. Young and old Christians across the years will tell you that's the way it works. Very often after conversion, after some forward move in the Christian life, the devil tempts us. And this passage tells us that chastening is a mark of God's love. And so Paul can call his thorn in the flesh a gift. This is an evidence of sonship and salvation. It's for our profit and welfare just down the page. And Paul again is going to say all these things have turned out rather unto the furtherance of the gospel. And then he's going to add in Romans 8 that all things work together for good to those that love God. Here's the idea that the Christian very often faces difficulties. And in these difficulties, he is to be mindful that whom the Lord loveth, he chastens and disciplines every son whom he receives. And verse 7 says, if ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. What son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? If you be without chastisement, then you're not sons. You're bastards is the old English word. The father disciplines his own children, and it's part of love to do it. I've been in colleges and schools. I've been in colleges for 50 years, almost, like a little over 50 years, if you count the time I was a student. And in all this many years, just one time, I've seen grandmother spanking a little boy and smiling from ear to ear all the time she was doing it. Just one time. The parent, the grandparent more so, doesn't like to discipline and yet sometimes it's necessary. If ye be without chastisement, then you're not children. And then verse 9 goes on to say, we had fathers of our flesh, our daddies, our human fathers. They corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much more be in subjection to the Father of spirits when he disciplines us and live? And then it says, they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure. Now, that doesn't mean they had a good time doing it. This is Old English for the idea that they disciplined us as they thought best. And God does this for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. And then verse 11 is so plain, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous. We won't cry and groan and moan and so on, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth a peaceable fruit of righteousness. And this, again, can be seen so plainly in little children. Little children don't want to be disciplined. The thing that comes to my mind is that our first son was born while I was in the army, and I only saw him for a few hours until before the war was over, and I came home. And my wife had taken such good care of him, but he was the only grandchild in two families, and he had 11 or 12 aunts and uncles. I didn't say he was spoiled, but I thought there were some things needed to be done a little bit differently, and I don't mean I beat him up, oh no, but some things I thought we had to work on, and so I disciplined him. And I'd been home from service, 2-3 weeks. He went to see his mother. And he said, Mommy, why did we marry Daddy anyhow? Well, that's what this verse says. No chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. And too often Christians just face their difficulties with grief, instead of understanding of this basic text, whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. And so, verse 12 tells us what to do. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. In other words, don't give up and just collapse. Move forward. Make straight paths for your feet. And then he goes on to tell us some other things we need to do. Follow peace with all men. Try to be at peace with everybody, including your enemies and folks that are not Christians. Follow peace with all men and holiness. Follow the holiness too now. Without which no man shall see the Lord. Without the holiness and the righteousness that Christ gives, no man can see God. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God. Let's be careful now that folks don't fall by the way or fail of the grace of God. And let's look diligently, lest any root of bitterness spring up, trouble you. This is something that in our language we ought to watch, that we don't become bitter against individuals and groups, and that we don't let this bitterness like a root grow and produce the wrong fruit. And then let's look diligently, and this is written to the Christians now, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau. Let's be sure that we guard those that we associate with from immorality. We'll do this by the way parents dress their children. We'll do this by the entertainment that we take them to. We'll do this by what they are taught. We'll do this by the companions that we choose for them when they're little, and so on. In other words, here's the warning against the great dangers in American culture. And he says, let's look diligently, lest there be a profane person like Esau. Now, that doesn't mean the other passages that talk about cursing, or cussing, we say colloquially. The point of this is not that Esau cursed, or that he took God's name in vain. The point is that he was worldly, this worldly, that he belonged to the now generation, and he'd rather have a bowl of stew than all the promises of being the spiritual head of the family or of the tribe. In other words, as a firstborn, he would theoretically have been the spiritual leader of his generation. And, Jacob sold him this stew, this bowl of, maybe it was somewhere between stew and soup. But Esau was hungry, and he was, in our language, about starved to death, the way the 8 and 10 year olds are starving to death when they come home from school. He'd been out hunting and just couldn't wait. And all these things of God, oh no, I'd rather have a bowl of stew, and I want it right now. Now, here's the worldliness of Esau, who belonged to the now generation in a very real sense. He sold his birthright for a morsel of meat, is the phrasing here. And then verse 17 says that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected. Isaac's going to say, no, the blessing has been bestowed on Jacob. And there are some things you can't change. Some decisions are final. And here was a man who had lived for the this worldly things. Now, in this next passage, there's a section that contrasts the Christian with the believer of the Old Testament. And the idea is, we've not come unto the mount that might be touched. We haven't come to Mount Sinai. And, of course, they were not to touch it. But, you see, when we come to Christ, it's not something we can touch physically. And we've not come to the things that were at Mount Sinai. Not even an animal was supposed to go to Mount Sinai. It was set apart to be the mount on which God gave the Ten Commandments and things like that. And now Moses was fearful. It was so sacred and set apart. But, verse 22, ye are come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to the innumerable company of angels. Now, if you'd put this with some passages in Paul, I think you'd have to say, you've come to the church, and to Christ as the head of the church. Here it's called the heavenly Jerusalem. Paul would call it the Jerusalem above. The city of God's people. And, the New Testament has a number of words for the church. The church is called the body of which Christ is the head. And Paul's going to do that in Romans and elsewhere in his writings. Christ is the head that guides the body, the church. The feet and hands and the other parts of the body do what the head tells them to do, normally. They respond. And the parts of the body cooperate. And that's Paul's illustration of the church. The church is a body. Paul says the church is a bride, the bride of Christ in Ephesians, to take his name, to be one with him. And things like this, to love him and to be loved by him. Sometimes, as in Peter, the church is a building. And then in Galatians 4, Paul's going to say the church is the mother of us all. In a very real sense, we receive spiritual life from God. But normally it comes through the church. And the church is to train its children the way the mother trains her children. The church is to love its own the way the mother loves her own. And so here we have the very simple idea that we've come not to Mount Sinai, but we've come to the new covenant and to the things of God in Christ. Now, that's spelled out still further in the next verse, verse 23. We've come to the general assembly of the church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven. We are members of the church. And I know about the unity now of God's people. The folks in the Old Testament were saved by faith. Paul's going to tell us in Romans and things like that. And yet there's a very real sense in which the New Testament church goes beyond what was in the Old. And we've come, verse 24, now this is just comment on the passage we were talking about. We've come to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant. That's what Jesus, the phrase that Jesus used when he instituted the Lord's Supper. You've come to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling, which speaks better things than that of Abel, than the blood of Abel. And so, be very careful. You see, this writer's always saying, now listen, let's apply this to life. See that ye refuse not him that speaketh. If these folks who refused him that spake on earth, folks didn't listen to Moses and sinned, they were punished. Then how'll we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? How'll we escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven, whose voice shook the earth? And now he's promised yet once more, I shake not the earth only, but also heaven itself. And then that's explained. This yet once more signifies the removing, the shaking of those things that are shaken, that can be shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remains. God sometimes lets things be shaken. The things, the material, the things that can fall, the house burns down, the body becomes sick, and so on. All kinds of material things are shaken. And the result of this is we realize there are some things that remain that cannot be shaken. Some things that are permanent, some things that can in no way be moved. And so, we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved. And so let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and fear. For God is a consuming fire. God judges. Now, I take it that the emphasis in this 12th chapter, very much following 11, is that we ought to take Christianity into our daily lives. We ought to take Christianity into social life and home life and into business and into our church life and everything else like that. We've had so often expressions like, let us, let's go on, let's press on. We've had in this chapter, looking diligently, looking carefully. And we've had the idea over and again that we're to look not only for ourselves, but we're to be concerned about other people, and that we're to guard the church against the temptations that come in the culture in which we live. We've come to the heavenly Jerusalem, something more wonderful than anything in the Old Testament. Now, in chapter 13, he says, and this is some more of the practical part, we call it, let brotherly love continue. Oh, that sounds like 1 John. Yes, but all these early Christians had the same message. Let brotherly love continue. Let's love our fellow Christians and others. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers. Thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Now that's talking about Abraham. The angels came to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, Admon, Zeboiim, and those cities down in the valley. And they came in human form, and Abraham didn't know who they were. And according to the polite and proper procedure of his day, He prepared a big meal for these strangers, and later he finds out that these are personal representatives of God, angels sent to do God's work, and of course in particular to deliver Lot. And again, back in those days they didn't have motels and hotels, and so the Christian was often to open his home to strangers and those in need. Now, there are some families that have a whole group of little children, and they can't very well entertain strangers. There are others, people, who can entertain strangers in 1984. There are people, as Christians, who take people into their homes in the name of Christ. And if we had 2-3 hours, I could use the whole time telling you stories that I know about personally, about these people who have entertained the folks that are here called strangers, those in need, and found great joy in it. And it's a way of serving God. We are to be concerned. You see, the strangers for us, the idea is of the travelers. Now, that may mean taking the missionary in for the missionary conference. This may mean taking in some child that doesn't have a home. It takes all kinds of forms. But I think this is saying to us, the Christian home should be a way of serving God. And may it be true that your home and mine will be used of God in His service day by day for Christ's sake.